Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. I'm Paula. Freedom is an idea for which countless numbers of people have fought and died over the centuries. Liberation movements were particularly notable in the 20th century and continue today. Our guest, Jerry Adams, has been leading a struggle against foreign domination that has been going on for 800 years. But most of what people outside of Ireland know about Ireland's struggle for self-determination is filtered through London, Mr. Adams says. So he's written his story to give a different face to Ireland's story.
I chose the title Hope and History for the Irish edition of the book, and the state said as a father journey. And it comes from a Seamus Heaney poem. And the poem, one of its lines says, "A father shore is reachable on the far side of revenge." And I think that's true.
Jerry Adams has been Sinn Féin president since 1983. He has twice been elected to the British Parliament by the people of West Belfast. Mr. Adams is a prolific writer as well as a lifelong political activist. A Farther Shore, Ireland's Long Road to Peace, is Mr. Adams' eighth book. Bill Russell and I are always eager to know another side of the story, perspectives that are too often lost in struggles against powerful forces. So we were particularly enthusiastic when Jerry Adams accepted our invitation to be our guest during his visit to Atlanta to meet with Nobel Peace Prize winner President Jimmy Carter. Jerry Adams, I am fascinated with what I think of as visual puzzles. You look at a picture, it looks like what you think it is, and then somebody says, "Now look at that same picture again and see if you can see the outline of a woman's face." I had the sense as I was reading A Farther Shore and as I was looking at Ireland through your eyes that you were saying, "Paula, look at this again and see if you can see a face in here that you've not seen before." Is that why you write your books? Is that why you are in the inevitable media context? What is that? What you want of me, that I should look again and see something new?
Absolutely, and you put it far better than I ever could. Essentially, people here in the States, unless they are interested enough in Ireland, unless they have family roots and are receiving information or going after information independently, you get your information mostly through London. You get your information through tabloid journalism. So what I'm trying to do in this book is to give my side of the story. It's a personal account. And the reader can follow through it and decide on whatever he or she wants. But hopefully they'll find a different face.
I was just surprised that time and again I would hear myself saying to myself, "I didn't know that. Really? And I thought I knew some little bit about Ireland." And again and again, you were telling me things that I didn't know.
Well, it's gratifying to hear you say that, because obviously part of the point in telling the story is to give the reader an insight. And I describe this in many ways as a journey and a process, but we'll call it a journey for now. And I invite the reader on the journey, and we start off at a time when the North was convulsed by violence, conflict on a daily basis, atrocity after atrocity, by huge repression, by a police state which was pervasive in all of its aspects, and by a huge polarisation of feelings, with a lot of that at times spilling into the south of Ireland or into Britain itself and to other quarters. And we journey from there as we try to find a way out of that jungle. And then we go to Irish America. We go to Hickory Hill. We go to the White House. We go to Cape Town, to South Africa. We go to meet with Nelson Mandela. We get the help and assistance of President Clinton. We get John Hume of the SDLP and others coming on the journey. We end up talking to the IRA, talking to the Unionists. We go to Downing Street, and the reader hopefully gets an insight into all of these places.
I was dazzled as you took me on this journey, how you were able to keep me enthralled in a, what sometimes in a just painfully boring process. Just the getting through the 30 years from, and always with the streets in the back of your head, that you are able to tell me that it's still thrilling.
Well, I actually, at one point in the book, put in a lot of the tedium because I wanted to try and give the reader a sense of just how utterly, frustratingly slow and boring it was. And in fact, when I was researching the book, and I could draw upon a huge amount of documentation because we, early on within the Sinn Féin group, kept records and minutes and documentation and copies of letters and so on. But I was surprised myself at how long certain phases of it took. You know, you think back and you think, well, maybe that took a year or so, but you realise it took 11 years or 10 years or 12 years to get from the idea of dialogue to actually ending up in the same room as an opponent talking to that person. So, I mean, that was an attempt to actually show people the tedium of it. It is a huge piece of history to cover. That's why it isn't a textbook historical, you know, tome. It is, you know, in the same way as you would tell about what you did at some big point in your life. You won't have to give every exact little detail, every exact date, every exact little nuance, but you'll tell in as interesting a way as you can the highlights that you'll try and convey. So I suppose the book is trying to convey a sense of all of this. And there are little things that grab me, for example, and I didn't... Some of these are cliches, but, I mean, the reality is that one person can make a difference. The reality is that, you know, when the two governments in Ireland and in Britain had their faces set against dealing with Sinn Féin, here they talk to Sinn Féin now as a matter of custom, as a matter of just of normality.
That one person who has indeed made a difference is Gerry Adams, our guest here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell is with me. We'll all be back in just a moment. Please be with us when we return. Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Today it's the Gerry Adams Show. Bill Russell is sitting here listening intently. Bill?
You had the grace in the book to put in at the front a timeline, which was extraordinarily helpful because it just goes on and on and on.
That starts starting in the 1100s.
In 1169, which sort of puts things in context. You also put in a glossary, which is helpful, and a list of characters, which is also helpful. But that time frame, I think Americans particularly, you know, our sense of history is fairly flat.
Last week.
You know, last week, last month, last year, you know, when I was a kid or something. And that's, I think, characteristic of the new world. You know, we've sort of made a habit of that. And in a lot of ways, you reach out and bring us back in you know, into the historical context, and particularly the historical context that is Imperial Britain. And as America makes noises about imperialism, or people say things characterizing America as that, it seems to me that that your experience is generalizable much beyond the experience of Ireland. And I sort of had the sense as you were writing this book that every now and then you were also showing us, intentionally or otherwise, I'm not even sure, showing us ourselves and showing us a bigger world that we need to be looking at.
Well, I'm deeply interested in international issues. I'm particularly interested in issues of poverty and deprivation. I do believe that we who live in the West make the awful mistake of thinking that we are the world. And because I have been lucky enough to travel and to go to other parts of the world, it's useful to see it from their cultural view or from their historical view. And I think we who live in Ireland, because we have a colonial past and present, we were the first colony of the English. We're the last colony of the English. I essentially believe that what our struggle is about the reconquest of Ireland by the people who live on the island of Ireland. So at different times, while I don't believe that we can be preachy or that we have lessons to teach anyone else, at different times I was very conscious of the international acoustic in which our story was being told. For example, I remember when the USSR collapsed. And what did that mean? I mean, apart from looking at all of this, it meant we had a chance. Because if such an empire could collapse, then we could change the reality in which we lived. When Germany was reunited, well then Ireland could be surely reunited. And when the great breakthrough in South Africa, when Nelson Mandela walked out of the prison, and as someone who's been in a prison but not for as long as he, that was just mighty. And then you're rewarded by the fact that so many people are of the same mind. You know, that so many people were joyous about Madiba's release, were joyous about democracy and apartheid.
Madiba is what his friends and comrades, as you call them, call Nelson Mandela.
Yes, yeah. So I am conscious that we are part, and I suppose, I mean, I would, you know, my big focus in life clearly is to make changes in my own place, but I do believe we're part of the international order, and it's a very small world, and all of us can impact and help and assist and in some way shape a better planet.
I was also taken very much in that context with your talking repeatedly about the need to shape a culture, move a culture from a culture of resistance to a culture of change.
Yeah, I think that's the big challenge for all of us, even in our own lives. You see, it's quite easy to be against something. In fact, it's sometimes very easy to be against something because there are so many things that you can be against. But to actually move from that into being for something, and then to think about how you would shape that, you know, how you would move from, you know, somebody's bullying you, somebody, you know, in our case, you know, we're being denied our rights, or the British Army arrives on your doorstep and kicks in your door and hauls your father off to prison. That's easy to be against. If it happened here, you'd all be against it. To be against British rule in Ireland is easy. But what sort of rule do you want in Ireland? What sort of Ireland do you want? And to be an agent of change, to be a problem solver, I think is a big challenge. And for us anyway, even though I think that perhaps in terms of being someone who is philosophically a Republican in the sense of believing that the people are sovereign, that I don't mean in the American or even in the Irish context, I mean in the essential meaning of the word Republican as opposed to a monarchist, you know, where, you know, I'm just against empires or elites or hierarchies or royalty. I think to be in that sort of a situation and to be an agent for change. So what was the big example? The hunger strikers in 1981. They were the people who, young men and women, 10 of the men died on hunger strike and had no intention of dying, didn't want to die, had many reasons for living, but were very ordinary. And I think that's something else which I've learned, that we should not depict struggle as being conducted by extraordinary people or big leaders, even though there are such people. But it's far better that we think of it in terms of ordinary people doing extraordinary things when you're pushed to it. So you, Paula, could be a hunger striker in a given situation, even though it's totally outside your experience. But if you were stuck there and it was driven to you and it was to liberate other people around you, you reach inside yourself and you, this extraordinary person, spirit, and it's not just Irish, it's universal. So I think all of that's mixed up in trying to tell this story.
What are you willing to live for and what are you willing to die for? Are both sides of the coin, aren't they?
Yes, well, it doesn't even necessarily have to be about death, although in the case of the hunger strikes, that was the risk that the hunger strikers were prepared to take when they placed their very lives, and there's nothing more precious against the will of a British government, in this case, a British Prime Minister called Thatcher, and they were prepared to go to the wall for that, for other people, to sacrifice themselves for other people. So, and in many ways, these are universal themes. And we'll go back to the point you made earlier. These are universal issues. You'll find it. Bobby Sands wrote a very good poem called "The Rhythm of Time" or "The Rhyme of Time," in which he writes about it's found in every bound and race. It's there in every one, and he elaborates on this in a very, very, very fine poem.
But Bobby Sands, for those who don't know, was the first of the hunger strikers to die.
And was the OC, the organizing...
He was what the prisoners called the officer in command. He was the person elected by the other prisoners to represent them and dealing with the prison administration.
I was quite taken that the South Africans came to call a hunger strike a Bobby Sands. That kind of transnational listening to people struggling for freedom.
Well, one of the very pleasant things that happened to us since was that myself and a small group of people, including all former prisoners, went to Robben Island at the invitation of the people there. And in the courtyard where Nelson Mandela and his comrades had been held, we unveiled a small memorial to the South African political prisoners and to the Irish hunger strikers. And, you know, this was people who never met each other, didn't know each other. And you mentioned that the South Africans called their hunger strikes, their protests, a Bobby Sands. And when we were told that, which we were on our first visit to South Africa, it was hugely moving that here were people the other way across the world being held in solitary confinement and were moved by what happened. And when Bobby died, they held a hunger strike in solidarity with him.
Very powerful. Yeah. This is Jerry Adams. Let me come back and let Bill Russell come back with the next section when we return in a moment with Jerry Adams, whom we are pleased to welcome. Currently, he has written A Farther Shore, Ireland's Long Road to Peace. It is both Ireland and that peace of which we will speak when we return in a moment with the Paula Gordon Show. Welcome back. We are delighted that Jerry Adams is our guest. Bill Russell?
You use in the book two words that one of which is unfamiliar and the other is increasingly familiar, the notion of a securocrat. I'd sort of like to explore, because it seems to be at the center of a lot of the challenges in Ireland and increasingly around the world. And the other is terrorist, which has become a word that is used more often than sometimes seems appropriate. And you point out that at one point Margaret Thatcher refused to meet Nelson Mandela because he was a terrorist.
Or at least she said that.
Well, that was her assertion and perhaps her view. And they're only words, but you know, the words sort of inform the world that we inhabit. They tend to define the way we see things around us. And part of the charm of your book is how complex things are, that it's not quite as simple as the nightly news might want you to believe. But I'd like to, if you don't mind, sort of work our way through the notion of securocrat and the notion of terrorist.
Well, one person's securocrat is another person's terrorist. That's the rub of it. The word securocrat, interestingly enough, comes from South Africa. It's a mixture of security and bureaucrat. And we use it, as I think they used it in that country, to describe those faceless people who actually have responsibility for your life and liberty, or in our context, for our lives and liberties.
It's the institutionalization of a security apparatus.
It's actually, you could talk for hours in this, because what the British did was, they did this in other conflict situations. They did it in Kenya, they did it in Palestine, they did it in Cyprus. Most famously under the tutelage of a man called, I can't remember his name, he wrote a book called, Kitson, he wrote a book called Low Intensity Operations. Yeah. And what he argued for was that there had to be an integrated approach. That all of the state's resources and institutions had to be all geared to defeating the insurrectionists. And that the law, he wrote, was to be used as a tool for the disposal of unwanted members of the public. So
that seems like a deep perversion of our sense of law and justice.
But that's the reality, and it's there. And under some Labour governments, and particularly under Thatcher, that was given carte blanche permission to do what it wanted. So that you have a situation, for example, in the period I write about, and I was victim of this, that you could be arrested and interned without trial, just whipped off, and that's it. You were imprisoned. Your house could be raided, your house could be searched, items could be taken from your home, your car. You could be stopped at any point. Your home could be confiscated. A whole range of measures could be taken against you. Inquests could be stopped, and are. There's still battles going on at the moment to have inquests into the deaths of people which occurred some time ago. So the part of the problem, and you're very insightful when you say this, part of the problem at the moment, I think, lies with the reality that the securocrats still retain a hold. And I think it's human nature. If people are in positions of power, they're unlikely to give it up easily. So from the securocrat point of view, what has happened since in the Irish peace process is unthinkable. That Sinn Féin would now be in a position of the largest nationalist party in the north, that we would have by mandate the right to be the deputy first minister and the other ministers, that, for example, Martin McGuinness would be the Sinn Féin Minister of Education and Barbara de Bruin the Sinn Féin Minister of Health, that the likes of me can even the fact that I could write a book and people might read it would be absolutely, will keep many, many securocrats awake at night worrying about all of this.
But it seems, part of the lesson, it would seem, from what you're describing, is we should be very, 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 very careful before we establish that kind of security apparatus
I think obviously any country has a right to defend itself. And there is a reality that a government may have to take up measures at different times because the country or the citizens are under threat. But, human beings are very corruptible and there needs to be plenty of safeguards. And I think, the things that I've come to learn about America are things which I value. I think that the notion of a rights-centred society, the notion of a republic, the fact that you have a Bill of Rights and so on, that you have transparency, that you have the right to information, that there is an election-based democracy. At all levels, people go forward for public office and, the elections in the north of Ireland were cancelled twice in the last year by the British government. That would be just inconceivable to an American citizen, whether they vote or not. They just couldn't imagine anybody suggesting that there wouldn't be an election, or indeed that the institutions of government would be suspended, would be just outside the experience. So there are lots of things, and in our situation, which is interesting, it doesn't just affect what happens in our country. It affects the British government and what happens in its country. And in many ways, they will be more victims of it than we, because we are the people against whom it's been imposed. So we will be against it, and we will look for better ways of doing it if we were sovereign and in our own place. Whereas in terms of Britain, all of these things are now becoming part and parcel of life there.
Dr. King, Dr. Martin Luther King, we sit here in Atlanta, where his bones rest. He always used to say, until everyone is free, no one is free. And it seems that that's some of what you're saying.
Yes, I think that there are lots of Irish ways of saying that. I think Martin Luther King expresses a universal truth. There's always someone who needs the help, the safeguards, the protections, the liberating influences, and while there's any one person unfree, all of us are unfree. I mean, why are you interested in Ireland? I mean, you have, I presume, a relatively comfortable existence here, but yet you're interested in what's happening, which I think is one of the great things about humanity. It's one of the great things which brings me back and forth. Why am I interested in what happens in the Middle East? Why do I worry? I mightn't do an awful lot about it, but why do I worry about the fact that people in the third world don't get enough malnutrition? And it brings home to me the fact that I think that people essentially, this might seem naive, but I think that people essentially are good. I think essentially most human beings want to do good, or at least don't want to do bad, and if given the chance, would be able to create a far, far better place for all of us. People aren't born racists. They aren't born as bigots. We're taught that.
Justice would seem to be a big piece of this. Paula quoted Dr. King, quoting the Old Testament about justice rolling down like a river, but she quoted it to Alan Dershowitz, who had written a book on the origins of justice, and he said, you know, I have the highest regard for Dr. King, but I don't think that's the way it works. Justice is a constant struggle.
Mm-hmm.
That you can't achieve a state of justice and expect to live happily ever after. It's not like nirvana, and that's certainly... And I won't say that you've achieved a state of justice, but it's certainly that ongoing struggle seems to be integral to essentially your adult life and that of the people with whom you've been working.
Well, I went into the Jimmy Carter Center here in Atlanta, and it's quite remarkable that this city has two Nobel Peace Prize winners, both Martin Luther King and Jimmy Carter. And on the wall is this little sentence, so self-evident, peace is not just the absence of conflict. I remember writing something similar to that. Obviously, I read it somewhere else. You know, probably if you go back to Aristotle, you'll find that someone... So all of these are journeys and our processes. You can't live on eating bread. You know, you have to keep moving at it. You have to keep working at it. And I also think, for what it's worth, that it's what makes life interesting. You know, perhaps at some point in my life, I would like to do nothing. But I do think that it is what listening to other people's views on this, trying to get into other people's shoes, being able to tell of your own experiences, and also some sort of a sense that life is unfair, and that's the way it is. There's no point pretending life is unfair. I consider myself to be very, very lucky. So therefore, as one of the lucky ones, I have to try and use my life to make life slightly fairer for others who mightn't have the same chances. Or if not to make life fairer, to make them more able to deal with the unfairness in life. And I don't want to be too pious about any of this, but I think that's essentially what it's about. And those who live in more developed parts of the world, I think, have a duty. It's a matter of our soul having a duty to try and highlight or to shine a light or to in some way improve the situation of other people.
The person who has spent his life doing that is Jerry Adams. He has written A Farther Shore about, as he uses the subtitle, Ireland's Long Road to Peace. I am Paula Gordon. Bill Russell is here, as we are both with Jerry Adams. We hope you'll be with us when we return. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are delighted and honored to have Jerry Adams with us. I need a couple of definitional things before we go forward. I did find myself being confused as to what was a nationalist and what was a Republican in Ireland. And then I need you to help me with why this isn't just about religion.
Well, a Republican is someone who wants to see a republic. Ireland is 32 counties. We are partitioned. The British have control at this time of 6 counties. So a nationalist would be someone, generally speaking, who would want to see an end to British rule in the island and Irish independence. A Republican would be someone who would want to see a particular form of government or society to come into being in the aftermath of British involvement in Ireland. And I forget the third
part. I was surprised, genuinely surprised, that this didn't seem to be about religion, that the troubles...
Yeah. Well, it is about sectarianism.
That's different?
Yeah, because you know, it isn't about theology, it isn't about the Pope. All of the churches in Ireland, historically, have been Christian. There has been a small... Jewish community, and now as Ireland moves on into more multicultural times, there obviously are other ethnic and religious welcome diversities and on the island. So what's sectarianism about? It's the same as racism. Where did it come from? In most colonial situations, the old adage of divide and conquer is how empires were built. In some situations, people were divided on the basis of their skin colour, their race. But I think universally, in terms of their gender, we've had that more recent focus on that. But in the Irish situation, just because historically the majority of people in the island of Ireland were Catholic, the British, the English as it was, for the first time used a method of plantation, which was later to be used elsewhere. They dispossessed the native indigenous people and gave the land to soldiers and others who were due some reward or some bounty. And they put them in charge and give them these possessions in return for their loyalty. Now, the first plantations, the historians tell us that the planters became more Irish than the Irish themselves. They intermarried, they got on well. So the English then looked for something which would differentiate the planter class from the indigenous people. So had it been colour, it would have been quite easy to understand. What they brought in was people who were mostly of Protestant extraction. And
that was a very important distinction, yeah, yeah. 300 years ago. As
absolutely, but I think now, I mean, because Adams isn't actually a Gaelic chieftain's name, you know, Adams is obviously a planter's name, same as Paisley. So obviously, the island of Ireland should belong to the people who live there, and you know, there is no issue of indigenous people or others, and the plantations are long gone. But the issue of sectarianism remains because for a period it was a disadvantage to be a Catholic, and you were discriminated against on that basis. And there was the perception of privilege, or at some levels a real privilege, to be a Protestant. And the Protestants were kept united around, and this is age old, it's not a strange phenomenon here in the south of the United States of America. The Protestants were kept together on the basis that if the Catholics got their way, they would take over their jobs and their houses and would run riot and would bring them down and so on. And it's all a nonsense. I mean, there are so many contradictions. For example, the founders of Irish republicanism were Protestants, Presbyterians to a man and a woman. The term Fenian, which is generally a term of, I suppose, of insult in the mouths of extreme unionists, really subscribes to an American phenomenon of people forced to come here. And some of them came at the time of the famine, and some of them came before that. And a lot of what would be called the Scots-Irish, who came in the first run here, were mostly from the Presbyterian background. And at the time of the United Irishmen in 1798, you had this beautiful alliance of Catholic Protestants and dissenters, which was the bedrock and remains the broad founding principles of both Irish republicanism, influenced by the American Revolution and influenced by the French Revolution. So any argument about it being about, you know, religion, and it's a matter of frustration that journalists use as a shorthand the terms Catholic and Protestant, when it has nothing at all to do with whether people are Catholics or Protestants.
There is a notion afoot that a lot, one way to solve the challenges that the world has faced is economic development. And Ireland has undergone in the last decade, two decades, a dramatic improvement in its economic status. It's particularly since it's been a member of the EU. Has that economic, tremendous economic change in the South had a positive effect, a negative effect, no effect? How has it affected what's going on, in particularly in the north of the country?
Well, it's had a positive effect. It's interesting, and on its own, it's a separate issue, that one of the effects has been that the gap between rich and poor has widened. That while Ireland is much more wealthy, and I use the term island to describe all of the island of Ireland, but the people at the lower end of the ladder have actually become worse off, even though we should all celebrate the fact that the country is much more wealthy and people do have a better way of life. And that has had a positive effect because, of course, the unionists used to say that they didn't want to be part of a united Ireland because the South was impoverished and poor and deprived. Now the South is more prosperous than the North. And in fact, the first element within unionism which were prepared to sign on for a new dispensation were, understandably enough, the business classes, because they could see immediately that there was a benefit to be made. Secondly, the island of Ireland is very small. The population is only 5 million. You could lose it in Atlanta or in many of the other big cities of this part of the world. To have a duplication of services, to have two separate, you know, health services, road systems, industries, you know, the range of duplication is through every aspect of economic life, and the economists quite rightly and the business people quite rightly say we need to treat Ireland as a single island economy. On to the European Union, that becomes even more of a case. So here you have the business people, the capitalists, the big banks, the financiers telling the unionists, you know, really we need to have a single island to have economic prosperity. So it's all been positive and it's all been the good, and that lesson hasn't been lost upon the unionists.
One of the things that I found surprising is how much time you spent, how to say, in intense negotiations with the government of Ireland. My assumption, you know, again, not knowing anything, would have been that they were, you know, at the very least, your closet allies, and if not, and the same thing really with the church. I would have expected that the Irish government and the Catholic Church would have been four square behind you, at least in private, and I would have expected in public. And that didn't, and I'm not sure still, if it didn't seem to be the case.
Well, the reality is that the partition of Ireland brought about two conservative states on the island of Ireland. One was the one which most people know about, which is the North, because of the conflict. But equally in the South, there was a conservative state. And, you know, after a while, and for good reasons now, you know, I don't want to be too condemnatory, but, you know, they were busy trying to shape out issues. It was very, very dark, black economic climate for a long time. Emigration was huge. The Civil War had a dreadful effect. You know, the Civil War, you know, even yet affects the Irish psyche. So it was difficult, but the reality is there was no strategy about Irish unity. The North was forgotten about, except at election times when the drum was beaten and the flag was flown. So when we came to deal with these issues, it became obvious that even though the cutting edge of change had to be in the North, that the change would affect the entire island. And some elements, some conservative elements, were resisting that. And similarly with the Catholic hierarchy, and I don't want to single the Catholic hierarchy out especially, but it gave the Caesar the things that were Caesar's and went along. I make the point there were no Martin Luther Kings on the civil rights marches, there were no Bishop Tutus on the marches, and I chronicle in this book, I think in some detail, our efforts to get the church hierarchy involved. And, you know, religion, like everything else, can be an instrument of empowerment, which is what I think it is, or it can be one of control. which I think in Ireland for a long time is what it has been.
You don't belabor it, but you do raise the issue of class. And for all the church hierarchy did not help some of the fathers, the people in the community had a
pivotal
tremendous effect. But I say that from the perspective of class. And are we going to talk about
that? We are going to talk about class when we come back. And Bill Russell will lead that part of the conversation with Jerry Adams. Please be with us when we return in just a moment for the Paula Gordon Show. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell is asking of Jerry Adams questions about Ireland in the context of Great Britain, about both in the context of the world. And class seems to be something we need to talk about on all levels, and at least in America, it's almost as if it's a dirty word.
Well, I think in many ways the issue of class is one of the central issues. Ireland, in a funny sort of a way, because it's so small and because people can know each other, would probably not be so class conscious. Although that may be changing now with materialism and with increasing prosperity. But the reality is that I know, and I take some, I suppose, I can't think of the word that I would use, but anyway, I enjoy the fact that a Sinn Féin councillor in an area is a woman who has no qualifications whatsoever, except that she reared, gave birth to and succoured 10 children, and that others who come from a different social strata are deeply offended that the electorate would choose this working mother over someone who thinks in some way that they have the right to be the public representative. And I think there are elements in the world, if you don't talk about class, that you just miss. I mean, the big section of the population in most countries now, and particularly I suppose in very advanced nations like the USA, is what are typified as the underclass, the people who live below the Richter scale, who aren't even, you know, who never vote, who aren't registered, who are out there somewhere eking a living day in and day out, the people who are on the lower end of the social scale, and in many ways who are if not quite criminalized, are certainly treated as social outcasts.
In a way, that sounds like, I don't know this, but just reading, it seems like you're describing at least a major part of the Sinn Féin's constituency.
Well, the big joy about being part of Sinn Féin is that we do have that part of our constituency, and let me tell you, that is the most difficult, for understandable reasons, section of humanity to organize. Because why should they be interested in politics? Politics have let them down. Why should they be interested in shaping out society? Society doesn't help them. So to be involved in trying to organize, structure, build politics is very, very daunting at that level. But the other great joy about being involved in Sinn Féin is Sinn Féin cuts across all of the social stratas. And maybe because of two reasons. One, the fact that we have a vision of the future, which includes a peace process, which affects everybody. And two, and I believe this, I said it earlier on in terms of the universal or international community, but I also believe that the vast majority of Irish people want a situation in Ireland where people are treated fairly. They want to have decent health services. They want the elder to be looked after. They want disabled people to have, as of right, legislative rights. They want equity and equality. And they look to people like us to try and bring that about, or to be part of bringing that about. And I don't think we have all the answers to that. So I think that you have in Sinn Féin a marriage of all these sort of different people, those who support us because it's in their self-interest to do so, because they think that we can negotiate better or bring about a better situation, and those who support us because of the big idea.
Which is?
The big idea of a free Ireland, the big idea of Ireland prosperous and working for the benefit of all its people. The big idea that you could, if you're an American, you could bring your kids back if you came here, you know, three generations ago because your great-grandparents were social outcasts or were outlaws or were politically dissidents and they were chased out of the place, that you could bring your grandkids back to a free Ireland. That big idea, that's what motivates people here in Atlanta or the Bronx or San Francisco as much as it does in Ballymurphy or the Bogside or Cross McLean.
Take this opportunity to do the distinguishing between what you so elegantly called physical force Republicans and what I guess I would think of as political activist Republicans.
Well, physical force Republicans, and it only struck me reading someone else's book in the last month or so that this is rather a quaint phrase, and I don't even know where it comes from. But physical force Republicans are those who support armed actions.
And that could be anywhere in the world.
Well, mostly, I would say, in the situation in Ireland. And political activists are activists, as you would have anywhere else in the world. So physical force Republicans are obviously political and so on, but see no alternative but to face up to the British in the way that the British face up to us. That may or may not be legitimate. I happen to think that at times in our history it has been legitimate, but I happen to think also that if there is an alternative, then the alternative has to be the way forward. And I do believe that we have the opportunity to make change through unarmed struggle, through negotiation, through campaigning, through propaganda, through publicity, through argument. And I happen to believe that we're involved in a battle of ideas, and that we can win that battle of ideas if we go at it strategically and energetically enough.
Did the so-called Mitchell principles, adhering to democracy and nonviolence, did that strengthen your hand?
Yes and no. We don't yet have democracy. As Mahatma Gandhi once said when he was asked what did he think of British democracy, he said he thought it would be a good idea. So we don't yet have democracy. We have we have institutions which are suspended, and we have commitments which have been not completed. But I think in terms of stating in a precise way, as Senator Mitchell put them together, a commitment to peaceful and democratic methods, that's bound to be important in terms of signposting the way forward.
You're right.
Bill never does this. This is a compliment to you that he will say your words to you.
That is you. Pointed out, deprived of any alternative, armed struggle is the response of the oppressed in any situation to their oppression. I asked you about terrorism, and we sort of glided past that, but it seems that to some minds, would be a prescription for terrorism. There is also still a great deal said about what is called decommissioning, that is, disarming the Republican Army, the Irish Republican Army, and apparently it's still a sticking point in the discussions. And I'm trying to the core issue, and there's an issue of justice. There's also an issue of legitimacy, and legitimacy I think confused with the law, but I think in some ways those are different categories. And in a way, you've answered it. You said, one man's securocrat is another man's terrorist. But there is a state piece of that tends to weigh
as in nation state,
as in the official entity that tends to weight the equation. States get to be securocrats, and those who are not the state get to be terrorists. But I'm saying this because you have spent years, decades, attacked, maligned for being either a terrorist or a close associate of terrorist. And at the same time, this world is getting, and we talk about terrorists all over the place, and we, at least in this country and maybe in the world, have become obsessed with terrorism. And I'm to the point I don't even know what a terrorist is anymore. And I'm really looking for your perspective, your understanding, to help parse out what is, you know, what separates a patriot from a terrorist.
Well, it's impossible to know, and to tell you the truth, I'm very intrigued that this is an issue. I sometimes get impatient with journalists, you know, who want to interview me for 45 minutes about the IRA at a time when we're 10 years into IRA cessations, and even the fixation on the issue of IRA arms decommissioning, when in fact the IRA is the only armed group which has actually met with the decommissioning body, put arms beyond use, and whose weapons are silenced. And that's I think all information orientated, because the only people they hear about are the IRA. They don't hear about the state forces. They don't hear about the other armed groups. And I think the issue of freedom fighter versus terrorist probably goes back as far as Cain and Abel, you know, when you argue it out. George Washington was described by the British as a terrorist. Arguably, the terrorists are those who fail. The freedom fighters are those who
write history,
become the statespersons, you know. And in our own context, I rarely deal with this, although it obviously is a huge issue here in the States. So what is a terrorist? A terrorist is, by definition, a person who premeditatedly kills civilians for political ends. Now, that could involve governments. It could involve armed groups, anti-establishment groups. It could involve groups of dissidents. It could involve domestic groups or international groups, and it's very difficult to get a proper handle on it all, because of course, when a country is under threat, it will always describe its enemies in a way which is dehumanizing, and really, it's difficult to know how you find your way out of all of that. It also suggests in some way that what you would call conventional war is different. Now, there is obviously a qualitative difference between people attacking a large group of women and children or a large group of non-combatants and those who would attack an army of the enemy. But have no doubt about it, war is horrible. War is about killing. War is about dismembering. War is about pillage. It's about rape. It's about dehumanizing. It brutalizes the perpetrators. It clearly brutalizes the victims. And there's a beautiful little song written by a man back at home in Ireland, and it's called Christmas Time 1916, and it's about the Great War, and it's about soldiers in the British trenches looking across no man's land at the German trenches as midnight comes on Christmas Eve, and they hear from the German trenches a voice singing in German the hymn Silent Night. And for a period, both sides joined in singing Silent Night. And then a white flag came up, and a German soldier came forward, and a British soldier came forward, and they exchanged presents. And they looked at photographs of each other's children and families. And they exchanged beer and so on. And then they went back into their trenches. And then the bombing and the killing started. And the last line of the song was, as they continued to shoot at each other, the singer says, "I realized that I had killed the man who sang Silent Night." And that's what I think war is about. The ordinary soldier, plain people, ordinary people, are the people who suffer in war. Rarely the generals, rarely the big politicians, rarely the governments, rarely the prime ministers or the presidents.
This is Jerry Adams. He knows whereof he speaks. We'll be back in a moment.
We have a couple more minutes with Jerry Adams, whom we are delighted to welcome to the Paula Gordon Show. I was quite taken when I finally understood the origins of the name Sinn Féin. Would you tell us that? Tell us what that means and why that is so important.
Well, it's from the Irish Sinn, which means we, and Féin, which is an emphasis on the word. We ourselves. It means independence. It's in its literal sort of sense, and it means independence from Britain. It means self-government for the people of Ireland.
The idea that Ireland was the first and the last of the empire seemed to me to go all the way through this book.
Yeah, well, I often smile to myself that some people in the British establishment think they have an empire, and we're it. It's very profound.
You one part of the appeal of what you have done is in looking at the future and making plans for the future. And my curiosity is when I come visit Ireland in, we'll say, 20 years, will I find you in the presidential palace? Will I find you behind that bar in Belfast? And what do you see for yourself?
You'll find me on the right side of the bar.
Whichever side that might be.
The right side of the bar is the part where they give you the drink. No, I don't know.
I mean, what would you like to see? I'm really not talking about you so much as you can.
Well, I mean, I do believe that there's a life outside politics. I am interested in writing and reading and cooking and walking and growing trees and looking after grandchildren and minding dogs and swimming and exploring and all sorts of crazy things. So I don't know what I'd be doing. I would like to think that if we continue to be successful and struggle, that at least I will do what I'm doing in a free Ireland.
And we have hopes for that free Ireland?
Yes, absolutely.
I have to say, just in closing, the hopefulness of your life gives me hope. Is that part of what you're trying to do?
Well, I chose the title Hope and History for the Irish edition of the book, and the state said as a father journey, and it comes from a Seamus Heaney poem. And the poem, one of its lines says, "A father shore is reachable on the far side of revenge." And I think that's true.
Jerry Adams, it has been our great pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so very
thanks,
much.
Thanks, Paula, and thanks, Bill.
A Farther Shore, Ireland's Long Road to Peace, is as riveting as it is beautiful. We are indebted to Jerry Adams for sharing his stories in the book and with us. We are in awe of the courage and tenacity of people known and nameless who have faced unimaginable obstacles to be free. Mr. Adams and so many others remind us yet again that one person really can make a difference. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.